We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. Welcome back, I should say, to hour number two of our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. For a long time now, Alexis de Tocqueville has been embraced by Americans for his support of American democracy. But certainly there was a lot about life in America that he found troubling when he visited this country in the early 1830s. He certainly admired our form of government, but he also was offended by our materialism, by our tendency to measure a man's worth by his wealth. He was also convinced that slavery would lead to civil war. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will learn some more about this French aristocrat who was such a keen observer of American life. And our guest for the program is Leo Damrosch. He is the Ernest Birnbaum Professor of Literature at Harvard University and is author of a newly published book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is Tocqueville's Discovery of America. It is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. He is also the author of another book, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Restless Genius, which was finalist for the 2005 National Book Award in Nonfiction and winner of the L.L. Winship Penn New England Award. And he's authored some other books as well. As we talk this morning with Professor Damrosch, questions are welcome. We welcome people by email, by phone. The only thing we ask is we ask people to try to be brief so we can get in as many as possible. But your call is welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Damrosch, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate it. You know, I think that it is the case that probably most people who have read Tocqueville know him by reading just little pieces. Probably most people have not sat down and read all of Democracy in America. If you do that, do you get a different view of Tocqueville than you would get if you were just looking at the little bits that people usually read?
Well, the bits that are quoted are, of course, the most memorable and eloquent ones. It is a strange book. It's a great masterpiece, but it's very long and quite abstract and deliberately written in a sort of detached, dispassionate way because Tocqueville hoped to influence French politics at home. So one of the things I hoped to do in my book was to bring out some of the fundamental ideas of democracy in America in the human context, where he actually got them from talking to intelligent Americans.
Mm-hmm. And you also have made use of material that was not previously published.
Yeah, that's right. There are translations of a good deal of his work. Many of his letters had never been translated, though I believe in another year or two there will be a new edition in English. And the great collection of Tocqueville materials at Yale includes boxes and boxes of loose notes that never got into the Democracy, some of which are quite fascinating.
Mm. You know, I come to Tocqueville after having talked last week on this show with Peter Carey, who has just written a novel. It's just been recently published, this novel titled Olivier and Parrot and Olivier in America. And his character in the novel, Olivier, is a French aristocrat who is modeled on Tocqueville.
Yes and no. I actually have met Peter and we got along famously, but it's really a riff on a different kind of rather snobbish aristocrat, which Tocqueville never was.
Mm. Well, the reason that I mentioned that is that one thing that Carey did say that I thought was quite interesting was that in his thinking about this character that he created, that clearly is not Tocqueville, this character that he created, he felt that the experience of being a survivor of the Revolution for his character was very important. Tocqueville himself was in many ways a survivor of the revolution. Some of his family was guillotined. His parents, I think, came very close and narrowly escaped that. How did that, do you think, or what sort of impact do you think that had on Tocqueville's character?
Well, it seems to me, and various Tocqueville scholars have said something like this, that it was his position between two worlds, as one book calls it, that gave him such deep perspective on modern democracy. That is to say, his parents were very reactionary. His whole family wanted the old monarchy back. He knew that was impossible. It would never happen. He knew that democracy was the wave of the future. But at the same time, he wasn't in love with democracy in an ideological way. He could see its faults as well as its strengths.
Maybe you could talk just a little bit about what was happening in France at this time. Because it seemed that this was after what had been a fairly significant period of upheaval, where there was a revolution, then there was Napoleon, then there was the restoration of the monarchy, then there was another revolution. And then at the point where Tocqueville comes to the United States, there was this a kind of battle going on between new royalists and old royalists. What exactly was happening in France right at this point?
Well, in fact, the very word democracy was a dirty word in France because it was associated with anarchy, such as had happened during the terror in the French Revolution. What Tocqueville especially wanted to understand was how American democracy could have been so stable. It had lasted for 50 years. It was going strong. He thought it must be a model that his own country could follow. But yeah, in 1830, the year before he came, there was a quite scary revolution. And because he was an aristocrat by birth, even though he had a government position as an apprentice magistrate, he was aware that his superiors were rather suspicious of him. They thought he might be disloyal. And he and his close friend, Gustave de Beaumont, who was his traveling companion here, decided they ought to get out of France for a while and find some politically neutral subject to study. And that was the American penitentiary system, which was their official reason for being here.
And so they come to the United States to do this study of American prisons, which they did indeed do some of. But clearly, even before he came, he did have something larger in mind.
Yeah, he wanted to understand both how American democracy works, but more largely what American culture was like. It was really the first truly egalitarian culture in the world. Of course, some people were very rich and many people were very poor. But in principle, everybody was the equal of everybody else. In France, as Tocqueville knew it growing up, you were born into a social rank and you would stay there.
Mm-hmm. He was only 25 years old when he got here.
25, yeah, and quite romantic, quite emotional. The dispassionate style of his great book was hard won. He was in love with the idea of the wilderness. He and Beaumont took a trek up into the Michigan woods where there weren't any roads yet. He was in love with the idea of Native Americans and very moved by the ones that he met.
Did he know really very much about the United States before coming here?
Not a great deal. And he says in one of his notes to himself, I want to study this nation that none of us know very much about. The foreign travelers who had come here, mainly British ones, were really quite condescending and snobbish. Frances Trollope, for example, the mother of the novelist Anthony Trollope, lived for 2 years in Cincinnati and went home and wrote a book denouncing the Americans as vulgar and crude. Tocqueville came here with an open mind and was surprised day in and day out by the things that he encountered.
Yeah. It's interesting that there have been some other notable Europeans who came here and came away with this very sour impression of the United States. Most of them apparently were English.
Yeah, and they were middle-class English people, and it's been suggested they were uneasy about their own sophistication and taking out their sense of superiority on the Americans. Not only as an aristocrat was Tocqueville kind of detached from that kind of jealous rivalry, but in addition, I began to realize, although his English was certainly good enough for conversation. It wasn't so perfect that he would pick up the nuances that would offend the Brits.
And that was actually something that I think you thought was something of a benefit to him. He might have actually have benefited from the fact that his English maybe wasn't the best, although apparently it did improve quite a lot over the time that he was here.
Yeah, it definitely did. By the time he left, I think he was quite fluent. He was a good linguist. But it did mean that he would listen with just as much interest to a backwoods storekeeper as he would listen to John Quincy Adams. If the person had something fresh to say, he would take notes and think about it.
And that's a point I think that you make in the book is that, and it's something that his traveling companion apparently says about Tocqueville, that he was a very good listener, and the things that he learned about America were things that Americans told him as he was just talking with people.
Yeah, that's right. For example, when he was in Boston, there were quite a few people who had been pondering the nature of American civilization all their lives, and he would draw them out. Or other foreigners. There was a German immigrant in Boston, a guy named Francis Lieber, who was born Franz Lieber. When he was a teenager, he fought at the Battle of Waterloo, was shot through the neck and chest, recovered, returned to Germany, and was thrown into jail as a political radical. By the time he got to America and was working as a journalist when Tocqueville met him, he was deeply interested in American government and American civilization. And it was from him, I think, that Tocqueville got the idea, though it was Tocqueville's phrase, habits of the heart, which the sociologist Robert Bella used as the title of an important book. The idea was, however intelligently arranged the Constitution and the legal system might be, they would be a mere superstructure if the people didn't have a shared sense of common cause, if they hadn't internalized habits of the heart. And Tocqueville made that very much the foundation of his great book.
Let me just quickly introduce our guest, Leo Damrosch. He's a professor of literature at Harvard University, and he is the author of a newly published book, Tocqueville's Discovery of America. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and it's just out. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Tocqueville was here for 9 months, or a little over 9 months, visited 17 states, so he covered a fair amount of territory. I suppose one might also say, was that really enough? How complete a picture could you get of American life? You've given even that much time.
Oh, he acknowledged it was a partial picture, and he originally expected to be here for a year and a half, and his employers ordered him to come home, I think because they believed it was turning into a pleasure jaunt, which to some extent it might have been. He spent about half the time, all told, in the cities of New York and Boston and Philadelphia. He probably did get to know the East fairly well. He certainly got to know Ohio, and we could talk about that in a little while. Mm-hmm. That was then the frontier, and he was greatly impressed with it. A brief time in New Orleans, and then a desperate dash through the South to get home in time. He admitted he knew almost nothing about the South, but he also said, since it's based on a kind of planter aristocracy, it's not really an example of democracy at all. Brief time in Washington, unfortunately, he and Beaumont were tired and homesick. They never understood the greatness of Andrew Jackson, though they had a brief meeting with him in the White House. And he acknowledged, you know, that these were first impressions. In fact, it was 4 years before he brought out the first half of his book and another 5 years for the second. And during those years back in France, he was reading voraciously, interviewing Americans, continuing to inform himself.
Just since you mentioned it in passing, you could talk a little bit more about the meeting with Andrew Jackson. I think one of the things that really struck Tocqueville was the fact that such a thing was actually possible.
Yeah, you could just get an appointment in the White House by asking for it. There's a story in one of the biographies of John Quincy Adams that at one point he was interrupted in a conversation with Henry Clay by a dentist who just felt like meeting him, and he excused himself and had the dentist pull a tooth that he'd been meaning to get around to. Jackson was a very controversial figure. He was the first populist president, the first that wasn't from the old sort of patrician Eastern stock. He had been elected in 1828. In 24, he had a majority of popular votes, but more than any other candidate, but there were several candidates. He didn't have an absolute majority, and many people thought the election was fixed when it went to John Quincy Adams. Unfortunately, Tocqueville first met Adams and other Easterners who assured him that Jackson was nothing but a backwoods bully and dualist and had won fame through a meaningless battle in New Orleans long ago. He never understood Jackson's great charisma or the political machine that Martin Van Buren, his vice president, had constructed as really the first modern political party.
He met Adams, and he was one of the John Quincy Adams was one of the people that he met in Boston. And it seemed that also what happened here was for Tocqueville that people like Adams were they were people that he could a little bit more easily identify with, much more so certainly than he could with somebody like Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, or indeed with the financiers of New York, which is where he first was. He thought it was an unbelievably commercial metropolis. Wall Street was already the center of finance. Bostonians were his own kind. They didn't inherit titles, but they certainly were patricians, Boston Brahmins, Oliver Wendell Holmes nicknamed them later on. And at the same time, Tocqueville was aware that they or their close relatives had created the American Revolution and absolutely accepted the logic of democracy, the very opposite from his people at home. But Adams especially impressed him because he saw him as an example of old-fashioned civic virtue, somebody who would lose the presidency in 1828 rather than pander to the popular vote.
Mm-hmm. And he was, that is, Tocqueville had some concerns that perhaps that in the future more American presidents would be like Andrew Jackson than they would be like John Quincy Adams.
Yeah, I think he did take that for granted. At the same time, though, he admired what perhaps today we're not so happy about, the ways in which, you know, every state, however small, has two senators. We probably have forgotten that it was not till 1917 that the Constitution was amended to have the Senate elected by popular vote. It used to be elected by the state legislatures. He liked the separation of powers. However strong Andrew Jackson might be, there was also the Congress and the Supreme Court to counterbalance him. But let me tell you one little anecdote. When he was in Cincinnati, he met a 23-year-old lawyer who had just arrived from New Hampshire and was thinking of public service, but said to Tocqueville, really, you just have to disgrace yourself getting drunk with the voters in order to be elected. But he said, you know, maybe at the national level things won't be so bad. And in fact, that obscure man was Salmon P. Chase, who did indeed become senator and governor of Ohio, Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury, the team of rivals, and eventually Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And Tocqueville could see that America offered incredible opportunity to people like that. Somebody told him that at that moment there were 36 members of the U.S. House of Representatives who had been born in Connecticut, which had only 5 representatives of its own, and the rest had just dispersed into the hinterland to create new lives for themselves.
He was, as you say, he first arrived in New York and there was maybe on the one hand impressed with the energy of the place, although was concerned by this spirit of commercialism and making money that drove it. He felt maybe most at home in Boston, perhaps because the kind of people that he met he felt were more like him. But as you say, the place that apparently impressed him even more than Boston, amazingly enough, was Ohio. He really was very excited by Cincinnati. What about that place got him so excited?
Well, it was still being created as a city. He said there are streets that don't have names yet. There's unfinished houses everywhere. Ohio was then, as I mentioned, pretty much the frontier, though there were people in Illinois and Indiana, of course. He said it's democracy without limit. Back east, it was certainly true that the established families had a kind of prestige and authority. In Ohio, everybody, like Chase, had just arrived. In the year 1800, there were only 50,000 people within the confines of what was about to become the state of Ohio. By the time Tocqueville was there, there were a million. So it was its openness, its freshness, its entrepreneur energy that really did excite him.
Mm. Maybe you could talk a little bit about New York City, just because it's fun to hear people talk about what New York City was like in the early 1830s. It was it was the biggest city in the United States, and certainly was this thriving commercial center. But it wasn't what New York is like today.
No, I think we'd be astonished if we could see it. First of all, the grid of streets didn't exist yet. It was from what is now Chinatown on south, the southern tip of Manhattan. The only grid that he saw was in Philadelphia, and he was shocked. He said they can't even think up names for their streets. They call them Third Street and Fourth Street. If you've seen modern Manhattan, he would have been amazed. It was all country north of Canal Street, so that, for example, when he was entertained at the country estate of somebody he'd met on the ship coming over, overlooking the East River amid farmland, that spot today is East 64th Street. He said, one reason New York is so boring is it has no skyline at all, not like Boston that has hills. It was just single-story or two-story buildings as far as you could see. Pigs roamed the street because poor people relied on them for food, and it was acceptable because they did eat the garbage. So altogether, it was a kind of, you know, racy, speeded up, noisy, confusing place that he'd never seen anything like before.
He was, as you said, he was here about 9 months or a little over 9 months and visited 17 states. He made a very quick trip through the South. He was out in what was the frontier, the West of the time. How hard would it have been to get around during that time, and how arduous was this trip?
Well, some of it was by stagecoach, and apparently they were appallingly uncomfortable. They had almost no suspension at all, just leather straps, and the roads were all full of ruts. When they could, they preferred to go by steamboat. That was a very recent invention at that time. And the great waterways, the Ohio and Mississippi especially, were really the lifeblood of the expanding country. The railroads were just beginning to exist. They were pokey little things. Nobody could have foreseen 10 years later they would dominate. But they also went on horseback when they needed to, as in the Michigan forest. And at one point, when the Ohio and most of the Mississippi froze solid, it was the worst winter in 50 years, they decided the only way they could get on down to New Orleans was to trudge 170 miles on foot through knee-deep snow to get to Memphis. So, in fact, it was quite an adventure, this journey.
So it was. Well, you said earlier that maybe the reason that he was called home was that some of the people back in France maybe thought he was having too much fun. Well, in fact, he probably did. There were also times when it sounds like it was would have been pretty rough.
It was pretty rough indeed, but also exciting. I mean, he liked living rough and camping on the ground and so on. He's a surprisingly adventurous and hardy character, as was his friend Beaumont.
Yeah. Certainly no, as you rightly say at the beginning, not like Peter Carey's Olivier.
No, not at all. And in fact, Peter doesn't really send him into the West. He mentions late in the book that he has been there and has written a letter home, but it's really about imaginary adventures in the East.
Yeah. Did you like the book, by the way?
Oh, yeah. It's a great read, and Peter is a wonderful novelist. I felt like, as I say, it was a riff on the Tocqueville story. His character has sort of the same biography and maybe to some extent the same temperament, but otherwise it's entirely made up in order to make this very interesting contrast with the aristocratic Tocqueville, and instead of his aristocratic buddy, with whom he actually did make his road trip, a middle-aged, raffish Englishman who has been a convict in Australia, which is where Peter is from, and in many ways embodies, you know, the future of democracy.
Mm. Tocqueville himself, now, while he, as you say, his was a family with long, deep roots in French history, an aristocratic family with true sympathies, at least as far as his parents were concerned, with the monarchy. Here, though, Tocqueville was a man who thought democracy was coming, and at least part of the reason that he wanted to go to the United States was to get some idea about perhaps what lay ahead for France. What really did he think about democracy, and if he did indeed have this little part of him that was royalist, how did he, you think, reconcile those two things in his mind?
Well, first of all, he really did believe that the old aristocracy and monarchy were fossils. They were rapidly becoming extinct. There was no possibility that they could be restored to what they had been. There's a great 19th century critic, Sainte-Beuve, who said quite wittily, Tocqueville did get married to democracy, but it was a marriage of reason and necessity, not passion. In fact, John Stuart Mill, a great philosopher, reviewed Democracy in America when it came out and said his subject is not whether democracy will come, but how we are to deal with it when it does come. So I think it was more a rational commitment to making the best sense of an equality, which he did believe in as a principle, than an emotional identification with democracy. Hmm. And democracy in America, indeed, is full of disturbing prophecies of some of the ways it might develop in the future. And in historical hindsight, it looks like he was right. Mm.
He and his companion were young men who liked women. Apparently, they did a lot of flirting when they had the opportunity. What did they think of the women in the United States?
Well, they liked them, and they were quite startled at how free they were socially. In France, an unmarried woman would be rigidly chaperoned. But on the other hand, once she would be married in France, it would be understood that she could take a lover if she felt like it. I thought the American girls were very forward and could spend time all alone with a man with impunity, and yet they seemed to be rigidly chaste both before and after marriage. Well, one blogger, when my book first came out, headlined his note on it, Tocqueville was really into hot American chicks. characteristically, though, he formed a theory of why this should have been true. Whether it's totally adequate or not is another matter. And his theory was this, that marriages in France were arranged between families. His own parents had barely known each other when they got married. They got along all right, but it was certainly never romantic. They lived apart for years at a time. And it would be just understood in that culture that naturally you would have a love life of your own, having satisfied your family's wishes by a kind of dynastic marriage. And in America, he said, this egalitarian society, the family is an essential refuge from the otherwise, wounding competitive individualism. And people choose a mate because they want that person. And therefore, fidelity is much more crucial, he thought, in America than it had been in France.
Mm. And so as far as romantic entanglements were concerned when he was here, it sounds as if he really didn't have that time to get that entangled.
Yeah, that's right. At many points, they were always falling for pretty young women and admitting, but 3 days from now we'll be out of here, so we'll probably never see her again. Peter Carey invents a love affair and an engagement that goes wrong, which is interesting to think about, but no, it didn't happen here.
Leo Damrosch is our guest. He is the Ernest Birnbaum Professor of Literature at Harvard University. He's the author of several books, including Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Restless Genius, which was a finalist for the 2005 National Book Award in Nonfiction. His new book is Tocqueville's Discovery of America. It's published by Ferrer, Straus & Giroux and is out now. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. In some of the writing reviews, some of the reviews I've read of the book, there was some criticism, and not of you, but a criticism of Tocqueville, saying that at least one reviewer said that he thought Tocqueville really didn't give enough attention to the issue of slavery. And it might have something to do, as you explain, with the fact that he didn't really get the chance to spend very much time in the South, although the point was also made that Tocqueville's companion on this trip also wrote a book, and slavery in that book was a much more important theme. What did he say? What did he have to say about slavery, about race relations?
Yeah, that reviewer actually was most misguided because he said he only gives one chapter to race relations. Well, it's an 800-page book, and that one chapter is 100 pages long, which would seem to me a pretty adequate proportion. What he did was agree that Beaumont ought to have race as his special topic, and Beaumont made the disastrous decision to cast it in the form of a novel, which he thought might be more appealing to the public, but he was no novelist, and nobody reads it anymore. But still, there is the 100-page chapter. And maybe I'll mention another encounter that he had, this one completely by chance, that I think had a lot to do with how he conceived that chapter. When he got to Memphis, just as they were about to board the steamboat for New Orleans, they heard dogs barking and drums beating, and a bedraggled band of Choctaw Indians emerged from the woods. They were one of the very first installments of the infamous Trail of Tears being relocated to Oklahoma. Ethnic cleansing, we might call it today. It was Andrew Jackson's program. He thought that they would never assimilate with American society and they were better off in a new homeland. I think his intentions were, he thought, were good. And even as Tocqueville was gazing with sympathy at this tragic spectacle of these people stoically and silently leaving behind everything they'd ever known to go to a place they didn't want to go to, when they were being put ashore on the Arkansas side to go to Oklahoma, a stallion came galloping up with a big strapping man on it, and it was Sam Houston, not yet the hero of Texas. He had been governor of Tennessee. He resigned after a marital scandal, went to live with the Cherokee, with whom he had spent his teenage years, took a Cherokee wife, and at this moment was on his way to Washington to try to persuade his old friend Jackson to modify his Indian policy. And at first, Tocqueville and Beaumont thought it's incredible this raffish character could ever have been governor of a state. But when they got talking to him, they realized he was very intelligent and had an amazing wealth of experience, so they drew him out. And the idea, I think, that Sam Houston planted was this. The Indian lives at the absolute extreme of liberty. From earliest childhood is trained to make all decisions for himself, to rely on nobody, to undergo testing experiences that are potentially life-threatening, and he will never assimilate. He cannot yield his liberty to authority of any kind. But at the other extreme, Houston said, the black slave has absolute subjugation. He has never been allowed to make a single choice for himself, and he has lost his religion, his language, his culture, everything that he had in Africa, but the white society will not accept him into itself. So he is a non-person. And those two extremes are the basis of this, I think, very powerful analysis in that chapter of Democracy in America.
And he did, Stokeville did accurately predict that the issue of slavery would drive the country to civil war. Did he, what did he think about the potential, though, over time for a kind of a multiracial society in America?
Well, everybody assured him that it was impossible. In fact, the Civil War, a lot of people were predicting, would have been black against white rather than what happened. But he did understand slavery was so fundamental to the Southern economy that it was almost impossible to see how it could be abolished. When he got back to France, actually, he was very much part of the movement to abolish slavery in the French colonies in the Caribbean, but there are far fewer slave owners who had to be compensated financially for that. What was happening, in fact, at this very moment was the nullification controversy in which the state of South Carolina was arguing it had voluntarily joined the Union and it could, if it chose, refuse to obey federal laws that it didn't like. It could nullify them. And Jackson worked out a compromise, or there might have been secession right then. And Tocqueville actually says, if states ever do secede from the Union, the only thing that could make it possible is if the army is split and part of the army goes with the seceding states, and that certainly did come to pass.
Hmm. What other sorts of encounters did Tocqueville have with American Indians?
Well, the first sight was a very discouraging one. They got to Buffalo, and it happened to be the day when the local Iroquois were coming to town to pick up their check for the land that they'd given away. And they got hopelessly drunk and were lying about helplessly in the street and being kicked by passersby. Tocqueville was just appalled. But when he got into the Michigan woods, he wrote a very eloquent account of it that's not in Democracy in America. It's called 2 Weeks in the Wilderness. There he actually met the noble savage as he envisioned them. These were people who were living exactly as their ancestors always had. They took on one of these people as a guide. He would lead them almost like children through the woods until finally they would see game, which he had seen from far away. Tocqueville said the power relationship is reversed. If I were in this woods all by myself long enough, I would starve to death, and these people, you know, make it their home.
We have about 15 minutes left, by the way, in this part of Focus, talking with Leo Damrosch. He's professor of literature at Harvard and is the author of a new book, Tocqueville's Discovery of America. It's just recently out from Farrar, Straus, Giroux. If you'd like to read it, it's in the bookstores. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have an email here from someone who said that they saw some of the interview that you did on C-SPAN. That was last night. I think that's Book TV is running an interview, and says that he was wondering to what extent our cultural antipathy to Latin America was evident to Tocqueville, and if he saw it, did he think it justified or excusable, given that you apparently said in the interview that the receding Western horizon was the key to forming our character?
Yeah, he didn't know much about Latin America. He did meet a man named Joel Poinsett, who had been ambassador to Mexico and indeed brought back the poinsettia, which bears his name. Poinsett was interested in the total difference in cultures that, for example, taking a lover was considered normal in Latin America, but almost actionable in America. But more than that, Poinsett was remarking that the Spanish, however brutally they might have treated the indigenous population, did intermarry with them, as to some extent the French did in Canada. And it was the Anglo settlers who absolutely refused racial mixing. So to that extent, perhaps he was aware of it. But the frontier, yeah, he theorized that long before Frederick Jackson Turner, who pays homage to Tocqueville, the idea that the frontier was not a line on the map. It was a moving way of life, ever opening up new land, not so much to settle as to invest. If you could clear a huge plot of land, raise crops on there, leave stumps standing in the fields because it was too much labor to remove them, sell the crops, cash out, move on even further west, get more land as an investment. But as Tocqueville said, sooner or later it's going to bump into the Pacific Ocean and it will have to stop, and then the country will change dramatically.
Perhaps we could talk a little bit about what happened to Tocqueville once he got back home again. We read him, and Americans, I guess, have always read him because we're interested in what he says about us. When Democracy in America was published in Europe, who read it and how was it received?
Well, it was really a great disappointment to him. The book was a tremendous success from the moment it came out, but he never had the influence on actual French political life that he yearned to have. He was always in the minority. The book got him admission to the Académie Française, the 40 so-called immortals, the highest honor a French intellectual can have. And it was widely read everywhere in England, certainly in America, where they assigned it in schools. But he got elected to the legislature and never could seem to make a difference. Even when a new constitution was devised in the 1840s, he thought he would persuade people to have an American-style government. They didn't. In fact, Hugh Brogan, in his excellent biography of Tocqueville, says that when Charles de Gaulle was elected president in the 1960s in the Fifth Republic, France finally had a Tocquevillian democracy after trying everything else.
Let's talk with the caller here. So we have someone in Urbana calling in. Line one.
Hi. Yes. I'm really enjoying this discussion, and I'm looking forward to reading Professor Damrosch's book. A couple of years ago, I think it was in the Atlantic Monthly, I read an article about democracy in America. And that I remember he did, it seems that that's where I read it, that there were comments, his comments about the prison system in the United States. Do you have any comments about that?
That's something we should definitely talk about because we talked earlier about it. That's the reason that he came here. He did, in fact, actually do some of that, did visit some prisons.
Yeah, in fact, it was more than a pretext, although, as we've been saying, he hoped to do much more than that. The reason they chose penitentiaries was that it was a very new concept. It had been theorized for some time, but only just at that moment was being put into practice. And it was in America because in France, which had an extremely centralized government, if you changed one prison anywhere in France, you would have had to change them all. But in America, a state or even a locality could devise a prison to its own satisfaction. The two that he spent the most time in were different in interesting ways. He spent a whole week at Sing Sing near New York City, which was only a couple of years old. It was based on the principle of solitary confinement. The idea was, as penitentiary suggests, the prisoner should be penitent. He should be alone with his conscience. Jails in Europe were holding tanks for everybody from pickpockets to mass murderers, and prisoners mingled with each other and taught each other criminal techniques and so on. At Sing Sing, indeed, there was absolute silence, and in the morning they would issue from their cells and go to work, usually quarrying marble for the mansions that were going up in Manhattan, but were absolutely forbidden to speak to each other or even to look at each other. And Tocqueville was very struck that 1,000 prisoners were kept in order by a handful of guards with nothing more than whips to deal with them because they could not collude with each other and the guards were cooperating with each other. He said, here in the land of the free, we have the most absolute despotism that can be imagined. The other one was called Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia. It's no longer a penitentiary. It's a sort of a tourist site now. And that was a really strange place. As Michel Foucault argues in his great book, Discipline and Punish, it was really a Quaker idea, again, to leave the prisoner alone with his conscience until he emerged a better human being. There it was absolute isolation. They could never even see the guards. The food would be put in through a revolving door. The only book they were permitted was the Bible, which, as a later writer said, however good must sometimes pall. It turned out that they went crazy. Reform was instituted of giving them something to do. Man might learn to be a cobbler. They would give him leather and tools. That did keep them sort of barely sane. But Tocqueville spent a week and a half interviewing these prisoners, many of whom were just there for horse stealing and crimes like that. You could get 10 years for that. And he was deeply moved by them, the kind of tragic resignation and fatalism with which they accepted they'll probably never see their families again. What was meant to be a humane reform actually was a quite tragically distressing one.
And did anything that he learned about prisons in America result in any sort of changes in prisons in France?
Yeah, in the long run it did. He and Beaumont, as soon as they got home, wrote up their 100-page report, as they had promised to do, and it was quite influential. And over the course of the 19th century, indeed, the penitentiary system did develop all over Europe.
All right. I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We have another. Let's go to them on line 4. Hello.
And can you boost the
and
volume?
I'm not sure if we have some sort of technical glitch. Henry, the guest said that he couldn't hear the caller. Well, we'll take another try at it. And if we have to, I can always relay the question of the caller. But
okay.
Let's do that on our line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I can hear this. Thanks.
You can't. Okay. Good. Go ahead.
I have read Democracy in America, amazing and impressive work, just the research that he put into it afterwards. So I wasn't surprised to hear that after he got back to France, he spent a lot of time doing other kinds of research into the United States. One issue that comes up multiple times in his work is what I kind of thought of as a great middling that he saw happening in the United States. That because of democracy, everything sort of gets pulled toward the center. So he didn't, if I remember correctly, he didn't really believe that we would have, that elites would be all that influential because they would be taxed or they would be in some way punished or pulled into that center because that's the way the populace would want it to go. And like I say, this comes up again and again, and all I was thinking as I was reading this is, boy, was he ever wrong. So I just wanted to know if I if my reading is correct on that or what you have to say. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's a couple of ways to address that, and one of them certainly is he did underestimate the gap between rich and poor and between inherited privilege and people who might never get anywhere. That wasn't entirely his fault because from New York on, everybody told him the rags-to-riches myth. And it's only a fairly recent work by historians that's shown it was a myth, that the rich people in New York were born rich and got richer. So Tocqueville kind of bought into that. He did, after he had visited England subsequent to America and seen the industrial system growing there, he did realize that the captains of industry might be a kind of modern aristocracy. And by the time he wrote the second half of Democracy in America, I think he fully understood that. But the other point, I think, is the more profound one. There was a guy he met in Boston called Jared Sparks, who was the biographer of George Washington and later became president of Harvard. And in fact, exactly the kind of American that interested Tocqueville because he was born on a Connecticut farm and rose to great eminence by power of intellect. Sparks gave him the phrase, which has become proverbial, the tyranny of the majority. But when Democracy in America was published, Sparks was quite offended. He said, that's not what I meant. I just meant if the majority in the legislature passes a law that the minority doesn't like, why then let them win the next election and reverse that law. But what Tocqueville saw was this, that in France, where there was quite rigid government control, all kinds of wild political ideas could be bandied about. Socialism was already well underway because nobody expected they would ever be put into practice. In America, he said, the majority really polices itself. You have to internalize its code and beliefs. If you don't share them, you better not say so or they will ostracize you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of middle that you're describing that later sociologists have felt Tocqueville was very prophetic about.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. We just have a couple of minutes left. Something else that Tocqueville really seemed to admire, and maybe, again, this had something to do with his excitement in Cincinnati or in that part of the country, he seemed to really admire the spirit of, the word that I would use is localism, in the sense that people felt that they could and should and did do things. If they saw something needed to be done, they just did it. They didn't wait for somebody in Washington to give them permission. And that was something that he apparently appreciated, although he also, looking down the road, said he thought that that kind of America just couldn't last.
Yeah, that's right. As I said, France was highly centralized. If you wanted to repair a town hall in the south of France, you had to send a requisition up to Paris and wait for the bureaucrats to deal with it, and months would go by before you would get authorization. In America, he said, they just get together and fix it, or build a road, or build a school, or whatever they want to do. And in fact, Josiah Quincy, who had been mayor of Boston, told him that, you know, we were self-governing for 200 years before the American Revolution. We just broke with the king, but we already conducted our affairs in town meetings and so on. Tocqueville was enormously impressed with that. But as you say, he foresaw, as the country got bigger and more powerful and developed a big army, it would develop a bureaucracy, which in the end would take over from the localities. And he said, people may not want, you know, a big government, but each person wants something a big government can give. And when you add them all up, you will have what he describes as a kind of nation of peaceful sheep who are cared for by a federal government that is all powerful. And that's why people from, you know, libertarian to conservative beliefs have invoked Tocqueville, and I think rightly.
Yeah.
He's sometimes criticized for you know, seeing two sides of every question. Well, there often are two sides of every question, and his assessment of democracy is very balanced.
Well, and that's, and I think that in a lot of ways his assessment of American life is pretty balanced, at least in the sense that when he looks at things, he seems to do a lot of, on the one hand and on the other hand, kind of looking at things.
Yeah, and that's how his mind worked. His draft for Democracy in America would have a nicely written out page with all kinds of corrections on the left-hand margin, and then pieces of paper on top of it for afterthoughts, and another piece of paper on top of the first piece of paper. He had a lot of trouble ever getting the thing done because his mind was so complex.
Overall, I think it's probably easy to pick little pieces out. If he said something or observed something and you agree with that and you say, yes, man, this man really had remarkable insight. If you look overall, though, if you try to take it all in, is his insight as sharp as you might think if you were just taking those pieces that you really agreed with?
Well, taken all in all, it's been called, and I think rightly, the greatest book ever written about American culture. Of course, 180 years of caused a lot of change, and if he came back today, he'd see a very, very different America. But I think he was on to some really essential assumptions and attitudes in our culture that have persisted.
There we must stop because we've used our time. Our guest is Leo Damrosch. He's the Ernest Birnbaum Professor of Literature at Harvard University, and he is the author of the newly published book, Tocqueville's Discovery of America. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And Professor Damrosch, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, David, for inviting me.